But in no other established democracy has that 25 or 30% translated into so much political power. Again, Trump and MAGA have never, not for a day, represented a majority of Americans. Surveys show that majorities of Americans, again, embrace the principles of multiracial democracy. America now has a multiracial democratic majority. But that majority has hurled itself against some of the world's most powerful counter-majoritarian institutions. Now, let me be clear. Counter-majoritarian institutions are a mouthful. They are also essential to democracy. Modern democracy requires the protection of minority rights. Not everything can or should be up for grabs in an election. As Justice Robert Jackson famously put it, some domains must be placed beyond the reach of majorities. I want to suggest that two domains in particular absolutely must be placed beyond the realm or the reach of majorities. The first is civil rights. Civil liberties like the right to vote, free speech, freedom of association, assembly, freedom of conscience must be protected from the whims of the majority. Pretty obvious. A second domain that must be beyond the reach of majorities is the democratic process itself. Elected governments can't be able to use popular or parliamentary majorities to entrench themselves in power. For example, by changing the rules of the game to undermine competition or weaken their opponents. That's the kind of tyranny of the majority that we saw in Chavez's Venezuela, with Orban in Hungary, and with Netanyahu's judicial reform in Israel. So we need to have, every democracy must have mechanisms to protect the democratic system from majorities that would subvert it. So civil liberties and the right to fair competition are essential minority rights. They are rights that require counter-majoritarian institutions. So institutions like the U.S. Bill of Rights, an independent judiciary with some review power, and relatively high barriers to constitutional reform, these are what I would call essential counter-majoritarian institutions. But not all counter-majoritarian institutions are essential to democracy. In fact, some of them subvert democracy. So just as some domains must be placed beyond the reach of majorities, other domains, I would argue, must remain within the reach of majorities. And let me just mention two. One of them is elections. Those with more votes should prevail over those with fewer votes in determining who holds political office. To my knowledge, no theory of liberal democracy justifies any other outcome. A second domain that ought to remain within the realm of majorities is legislation. Those who win elections should govern. Partisan minorities should not be able to permanently veto legislation that's backed by parliamentary majorities, provided that legislation doesn't violate basic rights. Institutions that prevent electoral majorities from winning or that prevent parliamentary majorities from governing are not essential to democracy. In fact, they are antithetical to democracy. The U.S., it turns out, has an unusual number of these undemocratic institutions. The Electoral College, which allows losers of the popular vote to win the presidency. A severely malapportioned Senate that provides equal representation to all states, regardless of their population. The Senate filibuster, which is not part of the Constitution, but allows a partisan minority to permanently block legislation backed by a majority. And of course, a powerful Supreme Court with lifetime tenure for justices, which allows justices appointed in one generation to thwart majorities for generations to come.
You're listening to Stephen Levitsky, Tyranny of the Minority. This is Independent Alternative Radio. For copies of this program, call us 1-800-444-1977. Again, 1-800-444-1977. Or online, our website, alternativeradio.org. That's alternativeradio.org.
Now, undemocratic counter-majoritarian institutions are often a product of transitional political pacts, pacts in which powerful authoritarian forces demand special protections in exchange for giving up power. We saw this, for example, in post-Pinochet Chile, We saw it with the Polish communists in 1989. We saw it with whites in South Africa. We see it with the military in contemporary Thailand. In all these cases, authoritarian forces demanded extra protection, a sort of leg up in exchange for giving up power. Now, we don't usually think of the United States, of our counter-majoritarian institutions, in these way, right? We usually think of our counter-majoritarian institutions as a product of far-sighted design. We think of it as part of a carefully crafted blueprint for checks and balances. That, I want to suggest, is in large part a myth. The framers of the U.S. Constitution were very smart folks, but they weren't out there trying to design the perfect republic. They were trying to hold the Union together and prevent a descent into civil war or foreign military intervention. And to do that, to prevent a breakup of the Union and a descent into violence, they realized very quickly that they had to compromise. Madison and Hamilton, two of our most brilliant framers, opposed equal state representation in the Senate. But when small states threatened to bolt the Union, they had to compromise. Madison wanted the Congress to select the president, like contemporary parliamentary systems in Europe. And he, Madison himself, preferred direct presidential elections to the Electoral College. But Madison's Virginia plan, which would have the Congress elect the president, was voted down. And Southern slave states rejected direct elections. So the Electoral College ended up being a sort of third best solution after all the other alternatives were voted down. The filibuster was also not part of the framers' vision for checks and balances. Both Hamilton and Madison strongly opposed supermajority rules for regular legislation. Supermajority rules were not included in the Constitution, not for regular legislation. They were not included in the original Senate. The filibuster emerged later thanks to a sort of weird oversight by early 19th century Senate leaders who were cleaning up the chamber's rules. And it wasn't until late in the 20th century that it actually became a supermajority rule on all legislation. So key counter-majoritarian institutions, things like the Senate and the Electoral College, were not a product of far-sighted design. They were a product of transitional pacts. But whereas transitional pacts in Poland, in Chile, in South Africa were temporary, America's counter-majoritarian institutions, for the most part, became permanent features of our political system. And those permanent features, I want to suggest, now threaten our democracy. The concessions made to small states in 1787 built a bias into our political system. It overrepresented sparsely populated territories. So the Electoral College favors sparsely populated states. The U.S. Senate heavily favors sparsely populated states. And because the Senate approves Supreme Court nominees, the Supreme Court is also mildly biased towards sparsely populated states. That rural bias has always been with us. It's always been undemocratic. But it never seriously advantaged one political party over another because for most of this country's history, both major parties had urban and rural wings. So it didn't really have a partisan effect. It's only in the early 21st century that U.S. parties have split markedly along urban-rural lines. Today, Democrats are overwhelmingly based in metropolitan centers, while Republicans are overwhelmingly based in more sparsely populated territories, smaller towns. That gives the Republicans, through no fault of their own, a systematic advantage in the Electoral College, the Senate, and the Supreme Court, which allows them, importantly, to win and hold national power without winning national electoral majorities. The Republicans have won the popular vote for president once since 1988. They've controlled the presidency for most of the 21st century. A popular majority was not enough for Joe Biden to win the presidency in 2020. He had to win by 4 points. Had he won by 3 percentage points, Trump would have been reelected. The Senate is even more skewed. In recent years, the Democrats have needed to win the popular vote in the Senate by about 5 points to retain control. So even if the Democrats consistently win 51, 52% of the national vote for the Senate, the Republicans will control the Senate. Senators, as you know, are elected to staggered six-year terms. So a third of the chamber is up for election every 2 years. That means it takes three elections over a six-year cycle to fully elect or renovate the Senate. The Democratic Party has won the overall popular vote in every six-year cycle since 2000. And yet the Republicans have controlled the Senate for nearly half that period. The composition of the Supreme Court is also skewed. 4 out of 9 Supreme Court justices were confirmed by senators representing less than half the U.S. population. And 3 of them, Gorsuch, Kavanaugh, Coney Barrett, were nominated by a president who lost the popular vote and then confirmed by senators who represented less than half the population. If the popular vote determined who won the presidency and who controlled the Senate, the Supreme Court today would likely have a 6-3 liberal majority. So our institutions increasingly allow those who win fewer votes to govern those who win more votes. That is minority rule. But I want to suggest that the problem goes deeper than that. Our institutions are beginning to reinforce authoritarianism in a couple of ways. First of all, importantly, counter-majoritarian institutions reinforce Republican extremism by shielding the party from competitive pressure. Democratic competition is supposed to work kind of like a market. So when products don't sell, firms lose money. And when firms lose money, they face pressure to probably change their CEO and develop a better product. In democracies, parties are supposed to win votes. They're supposed to win elections. When parties repeatedly lose elections, they face pressure to adapt and broaden their appeal. So when the Democrats lost 3 consecutive presidential elections in 1980, 84, or 88, they responded by moving to the center and picking Bill Clinton, the moderate, as their presidential candidate. That's what parties are supposed to do when they lose. That process of adaptation is not happening in the Republican Party. Again, the Republicans have lost the popular vote in 7 out of the last 8 presidential elections. They badly underperformed from all perspectives in 2018, in 2020, in 2022. And yet there has been no real effort to moderate or to rethink strategy. And that's because our institutions give the Republicans an electoral crutch. They don't have to win national majorities. They can wield a heck of a lot of power with 47, 48% of the vote. So extremism doesn't cost the Republicans today the way it would in a more competitive environment. Despite everything Trump has done, national power remains tantalizingly within reach for the Republican Party. They are very likely to win control of the Senate in 2024. They've got a pretty good chance of winning the presidency. So why moderate? There's also a danger, I think, that our counter-majoritarian institutions will be self-reinforcing, that they'll help to entrench anti-democratic forces. In politics, power begets power. The Republicans won the presidency and the Senate in 2016, despite losing the popular vote for both of those institutions. Trump and that Senate, that president and that Senate, then went on to fill 3 Supreme Court seats, forging a powerful right-wing majority in the court out of electoral minorities. That Supreme Court, in turn, has enabled state-level authoritarianism, upholding, for example, gerrymandering schemes that permit minority rule in several state legislatures. And in states like North Carolina and Wisconsin, gerrymandered state legislatures have launched a range of anti-democratic initiatives, including measures making it harder to vote. Minority rule is a uniquely American problem. In no other established democracy can partisan minorities thwart electoral majorities as consistently or as consequentially as in the United States. Why is that the case? Counter-majoritarian institutions used to be really widespread. States in 19th century Europe had all sorts of undemocratic institutions. By comparison, the U.S. was a progressive democratic regime. European countries had monarchic vetoes. They had indirect elections. They had unelected or badly malapportioned legislative chambers. They had filibuster-like mechanisms through which parliamentary minorities could thwart majorities. They had all of those things. But over the last roughly 100, 120 years, other democracies gradually shed their pre-democratic institutions. So Britain weakened its House of Lords, stripping it of veto power. Denmark, Sweden, Portugal, New Zealand got rid of undemocratic upper chambers. Germany, Austria, Belgium democratized their senates by making them more proportional to the population. Britain, Canada, France, and other democracies established cloture rules that allowed simple majorities to end parliamentary debate, thereby eliminating the possibility of a minority filibuster. All other established democracies impose term limits or retirement age on their Supreme Court justices. And every other presidential democracy on earth, every one of them, got rid of its electoral college. Argentina was the last one in 1994. So other democracies around the world have become more democratic over the last century, eliminating 18th and 19th century institutions that allowed minorities to systematically thwart majorities. Only the United States retained most of its pre-democratic institutions. So today, again, the United States is the world's only presidential democracy with an electoral college. We have the most malapportioned Senate in the world, except for Argentina and Brazil. No other democracy allows a parliamentary minority to routinely veto legislation that's backed by the majority. The United States is the only established democracy with lifetime appointments to the Supreme Court. Every other established democracy has either term limits or mandatory retirement age. And finally, among democracies, the U.S. Constitution is the hardest in the world to amend. We need to democratize American democracy. We propose 15 reforms that would help to ensure that electoral majorities win power and govern. Those reforms include a constitutional right to vote and automatic voter registration, include abolition of the Electoral College, democratization of the Senate by eliminating the filibuster and giving more populous states greater representation, and establishing term limits for Supreme Court justices. These are not radical reforms. They already exist in most other democracies. Making it easier to vote, abolishing the Electoral College, eliminating the filibuster, and ending lifetime tenure on the court would simply bring us in line with other established democracies. Now, constitutional reform is really difficult in the United States, but it's worth remembering that Americans have a long history of working to make our political system more democratic. Back in 1787, George Washington wrote a letter to his nephew in which he described the new Constitution, written just weeks earlier, as an imperfect document and said that it would be up to future generations to make it better. And generations of Americans did just that, from the Bill of Rights to the expansion of suffrage to the important Reconstruction Amendments to the Progressive Era reforms to the Civil Rights Era. Americans worked to make our system more democratic. But over the last half century, over the course of most of our lifetimes, we have stopped doing that work. We need to get back to that reformist tradition, and we need to put institutional reform back on the public agenda. We need to start discussing it. If we don't, we risk a slide into minority rule. But, and here I will end, none of this stuff's going to happen before 2024. And in the meantime, we face an imminent authoritarian threat. It is now clear, if it wasn't in 2016, that Donald Trump is an autocrat, right? He violated the cardinal rule of democracy when he tried to overturn the 2020 election. And he's been quite clear, if you've been listening to him, about what he will try to do if he's elected in 2024. He says he will purge the public administration and pack it with loyalists. He says he will use the Justice Department to prosecute and jail his critics. And he says he will try to shut down critical media outlets. I cannot, frankly, think of another major candidate in competitive elections anywhere in the world since World War II who's been as openly, nakedly authoritarian as Donald Trump. Hugo Chavez never said anything like this on the campaign trail. Erdogan and Orban never said this stuff. Not even Putin made such openly authoritarian promises. Given the pervasive semi-loyalty within the Republican Party today, Trump constitutes a far greater threat to our democracy today than he did in 2016. It is therefore imperative that we build a broad coalition in defense of democracy, one that is much broader than anything we are contemplating today. That coalition has to include everybody from AOC and Bernie Sanders to Liz Cheney, Mitt Romney, George Bush, and conservative religious and business figures. Building a broad coalition, and this is important, requires sacrifice. It requires working with people we've opposed our entire lives. It requires setting aside major policy differences, even on issues that we care deeply about, things like Israel, abortion. That's a big ask. But these are not ordinary times. If we behave as if we are in ordinary times, we could lose our democracy. We stand at a crossroads today. America will either be a multiracial democracy in the 21st century, or it will not be a democracy. Both of those roads lie before us, and there is no turning back. I'll stop there. Thank you.
I have two questions. One is about the role of the military. Prior to January 6th, there was a statement issued by the Joint Chiefs of Staff that said if President Trump were to issue some sort of edict to use the military against peaceful protesters, that they would absolutely not obey that from their commander-in-chief. And it seems that the more authoritarian our politics get, the larger the role of the military may come. So I'm wondering what your thoughts are about that. And also our very unique gun culture playing such a big role in campaigning. If you'd like to or could elaborate on the role of being the most heavily armed nation on earth and the threats to our democracy, that seems to me to be incredibly portending of a problem.
So the military is a real asset for U.S. democracy. I mean, I should be clear. U.S. democracy survived the first Trump presidency, and that is no small achievement. Extremely important. One of the reasons, not the only one, but one of the reasons why U.S. democracy survives, we have a number of very strong institutions. One of them is institution of civilian control over the military. And I think we have a very, very professionalized military that's committed to the Constitution. Now, but it's also committed to obeying orders of civilian presidents. So, and this is a problem that has occurred in other democracies in the world. When an elected civilian president who has authority over the military, constitutional authority of the military, orders the military to do undemocratic things, it puts the military in a very, very difficult bind. And military leaders, as you pointed out, worried a lot about that in 2020. And with Trump saying that one of the first things he plans to do is use the Insurrection Act against protesters, I'm sure they're worried about it now. It is a very, very big advantage. What Trump tried to do in 2020, 2021 is very recognizable to a scholar of Latin America like me. It was an attempted presidential coup, an autogolpe. Somebody didn't tell Trump this, but you can't succeed in a presidential autogolpe without cooperation of the armed forces. And so thank God he didn't have that. So the fact that we have a very, very professional military is an asset, and I think will continue to be an asset for a while. Gun culture is, I'm not one of those who thinks that the United States is at a high risk for civil war. I do think we are at risk for a high level of political instability, of regime instability. I think we're headed, certainly in the worst case, for a period of constitutional crisis, sort of sliding in and out of crisis, that probably will be accompanied by a moderately high level of violence. Very difficult to predict how much, but it's not unreasonable to imagine if we slide back into crisis that there will be a fair level of street violence. There already was some in 2020, that there could be political assassination attempts and terrorist attacks. And the fact that so many Americans, and particularly radicalized Americans, own guns is doesn't help.
My question for you is, I agree with your reforms, but I'm worried that maybe they'll lead to political instability, that if we democratize, it will create resentment in rural areas, in predominantly white areas. So how do we alleviate those fears, you know, on this path towards democratization as a result of that actually leading to more political instability and then the fracturing of our country?
Perhaps fortunately, our political system is really hard to reform. And so the prospect of even minor reforms, like making it easier to register and vote, doesn't take constitutional reform, or eliminating the filibuster, even those things are really difficult. And constitutional amendments are not around the corner. So our goal is to begin a public debate about reforms. We do not anticipate that there'll be a calling of I don't even support the calling of a constitutional convention to impose all these reforms in one swoop. Even in the best of scenarios, a handful of these reforms will happen over the course of your lifetime. So my hope is that they will, that the inevitably gradual nature of the reforms are such that they won't have the kind of alienating impact that you, I think, correctly foresee.
My name is Michael Forbes, and I'm with the Inspired Leadership Initiative, a fellow here at the University of Notre Dame. And I'm also a former member of the United States House of Representatives. Mike, thank you, Professor, because you are spot on. I am terrified that our democracy is slowly ebbing away. We saw what happened, obviously, under Trump and many things that you just referenced. I'm concerned, number one, the Voting Rights Act has been diluted to such an extent that, and the Congress will not deal with, you know, renewing the Voting Rights Act in the proper way. And it's just a further evidence that our democracy is slipping away. President Biden himself said he would not encourage them to do away with the filibuster in the United States Senate. And I really do thank you for what you're saying, because without being alarmist, it is very, very real that this democracy is at stake. And I'm wondering if you could just comment on the idea that, you know, some of the time and treasured initiatives that came out of the Johnson administration, like the Civil Rights Act and like the Voting Rights Act, have, you know, been diluted to such an extent that it's emboldening the minority. You mentioned the Electoral College, and again, nobody seems to want to take up that fight, unfortunately. And so we are looking at a very serious situation in 2024, if you could comment on that. Thank you.
Sure, thanks. Just a couple of things really briefly. We tend to think of Electoral College reform as impossible, and certainly it's not likely in the months to come. But we actually came, some of you will remember, very, very close to abolishing the Electoral College in 1969 and 1970. Both parties supported abolition of the Electoral College. President Nixon supported abolition of the Electoral College. The Chamber of Commerce, the American Bar Association, the AFL-CIO all supported abolishing the Electoral College. More than 70% of Americans did. It overwhelmingly passed the House. It had a majority in the Senate, but didn't get to the two-thirds of the Senate needed to push it forward. So it fell prey to the fact that it's really hard to amend our Constitution. So we've been close before. I don't think we're quite as far as we sometimes think. In terms of the voting rights, I mean, I don't think the Civil Rights Act is in the same kind of danger, but U.S. is really a very unique democracy in that it is always, governments have always made it kind of hard for Americans to vote. In most democracies in the world, certainly all the democracies that I know, government makes it easy to vote. The government sees it as its job to make it easy for citizens to vote. In some countries, it is mandatory to vote. It's considered a civic duty to vote. And in other countries, many other democracies, you automatically become registered to vote when you turn 18. In almost every other democracy on earth, election day is either a Sunday or a holiday, so it's easy to vote. Only in this country, going all the way back to the 18th century, has it always been a struggle to register and vote. And so there have been efforts to pass voting rights legislation to kind of build back after what the Supreme Court struck down of the Voting Rights Act. That legislation fell prey to the filibuster. And there are, as you mentioned, a serious debate in the Democratic Party about the wisdom of eliminating the filibuster. I actually had the good fortune of discussing this with a bunch of Democratic Party senators over Zoom. And a bunch of them pushed back hard and said, dude, we're going to be in the minority in the Senate after 2024. Don't take away our filibuster. We want to be able to block Trump. And it makes sense. If I were a senator, I would think similarly. But from a Democratic standpoint, small d, majorities have to prevail in the legislature. And in the long run, we are a much healthier democracy if we eliminate supermajority rules for regular legislation. And that may be, well, I mean, don't be shocked. Don't be shocked, and this is the last thing I'll say about it. If the Republicans win the presidency and the Senate, if they themselves don't come under huge pressure to eliminate the filibuster, I think they probably will do it, and I actually will support it if they do it.
And my question if you can share anything about the international landscape and the trends, like not just in the US, but different parts of the world. I'm originally from Mexico, and trying to understand how these trends are affecting not just the US democratic system, but the international democratic system that somehow we are all being affected.
I worry a fair amount about what happens in another Trump term. Clearly, the United States, if it was ever a model for democracy in the world, is ceasing to be that. And this happened before. The U.S. democracy promotion was slowing down before Trump, so I shouldn't assign all of this to Trump. But the U.S., there are a number of cases in the world where the United States just folded its hands, where it could have played a role in defending democracy under Trump. In Honduras, it was arguably a stolen election, and the Trump administration didn't give a damn. So I worry that the global environment for democracy will get worse if democracy continues to backslide in the United States, or if we fall into a period of crisis and instability. That will, I think, probably accelerate a bit what has been so far a pretty modest decline in global democracy.
You were just listening to Stephen Levitsky on Tyranny of the Minority. He spoke at the University of Notre Dame in Indiana. Stephen Levitsky is professor of government at Harvard and co-author of Tyranny of the Minority. This program is produced by Alternative Radio. We're an independent nonprofit in our 38th year. We are supported solely by individuals just like you. To access our complete audio and book catalog, just go to our website, alternativeradio.org. Again, our website where we are podcasting, alternativeradio.org. For copies of today's program, Stephen Levitsky on Tyranny of the Minority, and for his book, Tyranny of the Minority, just call us 1-800-444-1977. That's 1-800-444-1977. Or online, our website, alternativeradio.org. That's alternativeradio.org. PDFs and MP3s of this program are free of charge. Just call us, 1-800-444-1977. Joe Ritchie is our general manager and editor. I'm David Barsamian. Thank you for listening.
Fascism thrives when it's contrasted with a version of capitalist liberal democracy, now often called neoliberalism. Fascism thrives when, as Hannah Arendt says, individuals are atomized and they don't have groups in which they can belong and identify. For fascism to succeed, it needs to destroy all competing senses of purpose. So all that's left is your ethnic identity, your national identity, your religious identity, whatever principle the fascist movement is going to take as the unifying force to give you value.
That's Jason Stanley, and this is Alternative Radio. I'm David Barsamian. This edition of AR features Jason Stanley on how fascism works. What is fascism? Michael Parenti, author and historian, says, fascism historically has been used to secure the interests of large capitalist interests against the demands of popular democracy. Then and now, fascism has made irrational mass appeals in order to secure the rational ends of class domination, unquote. Fascism flourishes in times of economic insecurity and cultural backlash. Opportunistic politicians offer up a platter of racism, xenophobia, and hypernationalism. They stoke fear and resentment using simplistic slogans such as drain the swamp and build the wall. In the United States today, there is a whiff of fascism in the air. witnessed the march of white supremacists with torches held high in Charlottesville chanting, "Blood and Soil," an old Nazi slogan, "and Jews will not replace us." The president called them very fine people. Our guest today is Jason Stanley. He's professor of philosophy at Yale, and he's the author of many books, including How Fascism Works. He spoke at Trent University in Peterborough, Ontario, Canada. This classic from the AR archives was recorded in 2017. And now, Jason Stanley.
We've just witnessed in the country that gave rise to National Socialism, a party, Alternative für Deutschland, an ultra-nationalist far-right party, come into the parliament. And not just come into the parliament, but they're now the third largest party in Germany. They campaigned on restoring German national pride, on restricting immigration, on raising fears about Islam. And this should give us pause, because the social meaning of their victory is much more powerful than what has happened in a number of other countries. It's not their victory. I mean, they finished third, but they did much better than they were predicted to do in the polls, almost double their predictions in the polls, which is characteristic of these movements. That, I think, is the latest epicycle in a rollback of liberal democracy that we've seen across the world. You can ask your parents about what 2004 and 2005 was like. They will tell you that there were hopes for democracy. Democracy was spreading with the color revolutions in Eastern Europe. 5-6 years later, the Arab Spring, it seemed that liberal democracy was some kind of unstoppable force. That is, in hindsight, was a little optimistic. What we have now is we have ultra-nationalist far-right movements that have come to power in Russia, Hungary, Poland, India, Turkey, well, Iran. There are theocracies across the world that fit the structure that I'm going to argue fascism does, and now the United States. Historians always inveigh against generalizing about phenomena, and philosophers typically ignore historians. I will use individual cases as examples to fit into a scheme, but I think something different is needed than what the historian does. What the historian does is she takes particular countries about which she has expertise, or areas, and tells us the story of what happened with fascist or ultranationalist movements in those countries, and invites us to generalize and make analogies. I think that is not what the time calls for. The time calls for a scheme, a generalization, an abstraction, which we can then take to reach a social and political reality and see if our social and political reality matches that. And while it's going to result in missing out details, missing out salient and important differences between regions, it's nevertheless going to give us, I think, a rough sense. Because I think that there are these constellations of positions that come together as family resemblances. And you might find yourself agreeing with some elements of one position, and then suddenly you find yourself in a group that agrees with all of them. And I think that fascism is one such grouping. People will say, well, fascism is a movement that is so specific. You know, it's Giovanni Gentile in Italy, a wacky idealist philosopher influenced by Hegel who comes up with a particularly intricate view. Well, that's not how I'm going to take fascism. That becomes a philosophical gloss on a certain structure. And it's that structure that I think it's vital for all of us to have in mind. Now, my interest here will be, for the most part, in the ultra-nationalist ideology that is the basis of fascist movements. The dangers in my mind from fascism come from this part of it. I mean, there are dangers that come also from the completely authoritarian leader part, where the leader is the voice of the people, as Trump has declared himself to be. I am your voice.
in his RNC acceptance speech. But if we just have the ultranationalist movement that seals itself off from those who are not in the nation, that itself is responsible for much of the ills of fascism. Because that itself seals off our capacity for empathy. It justifies harshly inhumane treatment of our fellow human beings, from mass imprisonment or mass expulsions to, in extreme cases, mass extermination. The danger of fascism is present even if the mythic nation fails to be realized in a single powerful figure who is taken to be its personification. So I'm going to take fascism to be this Weltanschauung, as the Germans called it, this ideology that is opposed to that of liberal democracy. Whether or not it takes the form of a nation with an authoritarian leader or a would-be authoritarian leader like Vladimir Putin of Russia or Erdogan of Turkey, both leaders well on their way to leading classic fascist configurations. Ultimately, they tilt towards the idea is that the genuine freedom is being told what to do by the leader. Hitler, as we'll talk about later, calls that genuine German democracy, is when the leader tells you what to do. And he gives a good argument for it, actually. He says liberalism requires a sense of responsibility. But in a democracy, who's responsible? Nobody's responsible, because everyone votes. And under true German democracy, one person is responsible, the leader. So there's real liberal responsibility. I encourage us to think outside these left and right categories, because the left and right categories aren't super helpful. Because it's tempting to think that left and right can be used as opposite poles of measurement along some kind of linear political spectrum, with fascism on the right and communism on the left. This temptation should be resisted. The words left and right are highly contingent social constructs that lack the kind of conceptual coherence that this fiction suggests. To take one example, both the Soviet Union under Stalin and Cuba under Fidel Castro instituted harshly repressive measures against homosexuals. And yet anti-gay politics is a stereotypical feature of the contemporary political right and not the contemporary political left. Furthermore, though we think of the Soviet Union as communist, Stalin introduced a decidedly nationalistic element into Soviet politics, which is a mark of the right-wing structure. There are present-day examples of nationalist movements, on the other hand, so those are communist movements with what we think of from our perspective as right-wing elements. There are present-day examples of nationalist movements with a modicum of stereotypically leftist elements, a vision of a social welfare state, say, but restricted to Europeans, and exclusionary of our Muslim fellow citizens, or Middle Eastern immigrants. Though typically, it must be said, this is a model of a social welfare system that's meant to encourage motherhood and encourage women to stay at home, the patriarchal family being an essential part of fascist ideology. Nevertheless, social welfare systems would be considered to be characteristic elements of the political left from our perspective. Criticisms of elites arise from both the left and the right. So you find both Bernie Sanders supporters in the 2016 election and Donald Trump supporters harshly criticizing the elites. So there are libertarians who strongly oppose any kind of redistribution of resources, and from this perspective seem to be on the right, and yet who equally strongly reject the kind of law and order politics that comes with fascist movements, as well as the militarism characteristic of fascism. So the simplistic fiction of the linear political spectrum with fascism on the right and communism on the left simply fails to do justice to the complexity of social and political reality. The words left and right allow considerable mixing and matching of positions. I discovered this once in a debate in the Yale Political Union, a wonderful institution, there's the party of the right, the conservatives, the party of the left, the liberals. And I found that when I would quote Noam Chomsky and say it was Noam Chomsky, the party of the left would cheer and the party of the right and the conservatives would boo. But if I would just quote Noam Chomsky without saying it was Noam Chomsky, the party of the right would cheer and the party of the left would boo. So right and left are positions that are highly contingent social constructions. These caveats aside, fascism is a position considerably harder, if not impossible, to reach from configurations we would now think of as on the left. A strong rejection of female equality is an essential feature of fascism. I would say an essential feature of fascism. But a denial of full gender equality is flatly inconsistent with contemporary understandings of leftist politics. More generally, fascism is the denial of equality. Fascism denies equality as a myth. And yet some version of equality is a goal that unifies otherwise very different leftist movements. Furthermore, if we look at the world today, fascism is a position that's emerging exclusively from elements of what are now considered the political right. For example, in Poland, France, Turkey, Germany, and the United States. Many of the classic books about fascism, most notably Hannah Arendt's The Origins of Totalitarianism, do not theorize about fascism in isolation. They're rather attempts to give an account of totalitarianism, with both certain versions of communism, like Stalinism, and national socialism, and European fascist movements, theorized as different species of totalitarianism. This is the open versus the closed society motif. And to be clear, extreme repression, mass expulsion, and imprisonment, and mass extermination have been justified by fascist and communist regimes alike. Though by no means all fascist states, and by no means all communist states, have gone to those extremes. Nevertheless, especially right now, I think it is an error to discuss these movements together under one umbrella. My first reason is a practical reason. When you discuss these movements together, you're suggesting that communism is right now a serious threat in the countries that face threats from fascist movements. For example, Hungary, Poland, the United States, and Russia. Fascism thrives only when there is a sense, often manufactured, of the threat of communist takeover. As Joseph Goebbels, who is to become Nazi propaganda minister, writes when ruminating about how to encourage National Socialist sentiment, the middle class sees in Bolshevism not so much the subverter of national will and folkish instinct, but mainly the thief of its property, the uncomfortable disturber of peace and quiet. It also sees our National Socialist will for freedom from this point of view. We are its last consolation and last hope if Bolshevism is around the corner. The less Bolshevism threatens, the less the ordinary burgher cares about us, the more serenely he smiles at our desperate struggle. Overhyped and exaggerated fears of encroaching communism were essential to the success of the National Socialists in Germany in the late 1920s and 1930s. In his classic study of the fall of the ordinary German town of Thalberg to the National Socialist Party, called The Nazi Seizure of Power, The Experience of a Single German Town, 1930 to 1935, historian William Sheridan Allen writes, "To most Thalbergers, the NSDAP was first and foremost an anti-Marxist party. When a Thalberger thought of Marxism, he was not likely to think of the communists, who in 1928 had received only 28 of the 5,372 votes in the town. So the communists were no threat at all in Thalberg. The quote-unquote Marxist party in Thalberg was the Social Democratic Party. In other words, you know, the liberal party, like the Democrats in the United States. The SPD, the socialists. The socialists were the dominant political force in Thalberg. In the 1928 elections, they received almost 45% of the town's votes, more than the next three largest parties combined. It's by representing ordinary center-left politics as threatening communism that fascists come to power. And that is textbook. When I talk about communism, we're talking about Pol Pot, when we're talking about Stalin, we're talking about murderous movements that slaughtered people. These are not fears here, but is it the case that historically communist regimes in the true sense of communists have used fascism as an enemy? Sure. And certainly in Germany as well, where there was a communist movement that rose alongside. What we're seeing is a repeat of history. When you have one kind of extremist politics, you have the other. I certainly wouldn't paint the Antifa movement as the Antifa movement. This is normal what we're seeing. In the 1920s, in Thalberg, when the ultranationalists tried to do a play about German folk identity, the students from the university came and tried to shut the play down. This is not new, what we're seeing. This is a repetition of history. How does history regard those students? History doesn't condemn those students. In Thalberg, there were battles with bricks on the streets between the ultranationalists and the students who were trying to shut the ultranationalists down. You know, should the students have not tried to shut the ultranationalists down? I don't know. Those are difficult questions about strategy. But the fact is, when ultranationalist movements are out there, there are fights. And that's true today. It's always been true. Viktor Klemperer, in The Language of the Third Reich, talks about a nurse who says, you can always tell the communists from the fascists apart in the hospital ward. The fascists have lumps on their head and the communists have stilettos in their hearts. One reason not to fight fascists is they're going to win. They have more guns. And the anti-fascist movement is not in a position, if there's some kind of authoritarian takeover, to fight it. So the only way is to win the middle. But there are strategic questions when you fight ultranationalism. I mean, we really have to distinguish liberalism, so I'm going to defend something called liberalism. There are plenty of right-wing people who are liberals. When you look at American politics, the Republican Party is much further to the right than any of your parties. Stephen Harper still would have been a Democrat. Now, it's true that in the universities, gender equality, there are movements for equality, there's a liberal commitment to equality. And when you start to tar universities, that commitment as a liberal communist commitment, then we get into worrisome historical and theoretical trends. In Poland, the takeover of the government by the theocratic fascist Law and Justice Party exploited the strategy of fanning fear of non-existent communists. Poland has suffered so much from communism that you're not going to find communists in Poland. And yet you still find these conspiracy theorists about communists that motivated the takeover of the country in 2015 by Law and Justice from a party that had been expanding the GDP of Poland dramatically. And in recent U.S. politics, we see clear echoes of this. President Obama was regularly called a socialist, a Marxist, a communist. How many communists give trillions to banks? And most recently, we find university professors tarred as cultural Marxists. Departments of women's studies, critical race studies, were told about the dangers of cultural Marxism. And it's that moment, that attempt to spur fear of communism, that spurs fascist movements. If I were to discuss fascism and communism together, it would suggest that communism is a significant risk in countries like the United States. And it is not. So that first reason is practical. My second reason is theoretical. The ideologies of fascism and communism are very distinct. The most obvious is that communism, like liberal democracy, has equality as an ideal. For the fascist, in contrast, equality is a counter-ideal. Equality is what you are arguing against. Equality is a myth. It's the enemy. You know, the Marxists try to tell us we're equal when we're not. Communist propaganda praises equality. Fascist propaganda attacks it, as we will see, as inconsistent with nature. To take a less obvious example, fascism theorizes a mythic past, one in which the nation-state was ethnically or religiously pure. There was no degeneracy, women played traditional gender roles, etc. In contrast, communism has at its center a mythic future, a workers' paradise where equality has been realized. These are very different structural configurations. You don't find medieval studies and runology thriving in communist regimes. The difference in the ideologies of fascism and communism shapes the way in which they can be used to justify oppression. Communism, characteristically, when it's used to oppress, as in Cambodia, is used to send people to re-education camps or labor camps to learn to be equalized. And with a goal of a mythic utopian future in which equality is realized, to use their brutality against dissident intellectuals and other members of the supposed elite. Fascist regimes justify oppressive practices by dehumanizing or otherwise devaluing some targeted group as a threat to the purity, cultural or ethnic, of the true nation that supposedly existed in the mythic past. The result can be the same, but the justifications are importantly different. And you have to know what kind of justification you're encountering. I'm not using fascism as a word that means there's no justification. I'm using it as a description of the politics you described. But, you know, there are many fascist movements that did not come with mass extermination. National socialism is an extreme version, but fascist movements, like Italy was hearkening back to Rome, Italy was... So when you're talking about fascist movements, there are many countries, Poland today, Hungary. These are not countries that have engaged in genocide. So I am talking about those movements, but what I am going to say is that when you talk about going back to a past, that that past never existed. I mean, Germany, you know, Mussolini talked about Rome. Rome was filled with immigrants. And, you know, I mean, there's these contradictions in the mythic. So that's the notion of a mythic past. So you elegantly and ably described the self-image of these movements. Though I think when you look at Goebbels and Hitler and what they say, they actually don't think that what they're sort of driven by a sort of vision. I mean, it's complex in the case of Hitler. I mean, he saw this sort of grand, you know, what economic, it wasn't economic revival, it was economic domination and imperialism. And my focus is on what I think is the greater threat for the countries we live in, which are the ultranationalist movements on the political right that I'm calling fascism. I have ruined many a dinner party by arguing about who is worse, Hitler or Stalin. And as your elder, I can inform you, this is not a route to take. They both were really bad. It must be said that Stalin was a nationalist. This is the Stalin-Trotsky debate, who rejected the importation of the revolution because it was a national movement. So there's elements of fascism in Stalin. There are times and places in which communist authoritarianism should be of concern. And in the United States, in many countries, communist authoritarianism has never been a significant concern. Rather, communist is a label used to demonize those arguing for equality. Even religious leaders such as the Reverend Martin Luther King Jr. were called communists. The word communist is used in the United States to tar movements seeking equality. Why give lectures describing the structure of fascism? Why is it important for us to know how this structure works? First, politics involves what we might think of as a marriage of convenience problem. One's commitment to a specific issue might lead one to join with others in a marriage of convenience. Maybe they're white nationalists. Maybe you're into Christian nationalism. So these marriages of convenience can land people in alliances. And what ends up happening is you end up in an essentially fascist structure. Without an understanding of fascism, one might not be aware when one is aiding and abetting fascist movements in such partnerships. I suppose one of history's classic examples is when corporatists, when those who own factories, oligarchs in Russia, for example, or corporations in Portugal and in Germany, aided the fascist movements because they had the joint goal of smashing labor unions, only to find out later that maybe this wasn't going to result in allowing their gay friends to live normal lives. Fear of fascism is often used to justify accommodating ever more anti-democratic measures. Let's placate the fascists, so let's have harsher immigration policies. But we have to know when that's happening. Even sliding part of the way towards fascism is something to be avoided. But to avoid it, one must know what we are sliding towards. Thirdly, and most importantly, without a clear understanding of fascism, we will not be aware of indicators of susceptibility in our own political environment. The United States has always had fascist elements in its politics. And these fascist elements deeply influenced Adolf Hitler. At the heart of fascism is the notion of what Hitler calls in Mein Kampf the national state. in describing the restrictive immigration policies adopted by this country, by the United States, not this country, in the early 1920s, Hitler in Mein Kampf writes, "I know this is unwelcome to hear, but anything crazier and less thought out than our present laws of state citizenship is hardly possible to conceive. But there is at least one state in which feeble attempts to achieve a better arrangement are apparent. I, of course, do not mean our pattern German Republic, but the United States of America, where they are trying, partially at any rate, to include common sense in their councils. They refuse to allow immigration of elements which are bad from the health point of view, and absolutely forbid naturalization of certain defined races, and thus are making a modest direction in the direction of something not unlike the conception of the national state." That's from Mein Kampf. And there are many more passages in which Hitler praises the United States' incredibly restrictive, ethnically based immigration policies from 1924 on. The current president of the United States, Donald Trump, rode to electoral victory with a campaign of frank and open nostalgia about these very immigration policies. And this is but one of the elements of fascism that laces through present-day U.S. politics. Many of you are familiar with German pastor Martin Niemöller's speech, "First They Came," given as a critique of German cowardice before Nazi purges. However, insufficient attention is given to the targeted categories it mentions. And the targeted categories help you think about fascism. In the most well-known version of the speech, it is, "First they came for the socialists, and I did not speak out because I was not a socialist. Then they came for the trade unionists, and I did not speak out because I was not a trade unionist. Then they came for the Jews, and I did not speak out because I was not a Jew. Then they came for me, and there was no one left to speak for me." National socialism is a particular version of fascism that places Jews at the center of a conspiratorial web to advance equality in the service of destroying the traditional nation. But fascism does not require Jews to play this role. It only requires somebody to play this role. Socialists will do, Muslims will do, non-whites will do. However, fascism of any variety harshly targets trade unionists, that is, members of labor unions. In the opening pages of Mein Kampf, Hitler writes, "The free trades union lowered over the political horizon and over each man's life like a threatening storm cloud. It was one of the most terrible instruments of intimidation against security and national independence, the solidity of the state and individual freedom. It was, above all, that which turned the idea of democracy into a repellent and derisory phrase, brought shame to liberty, and mocked at brotherhoods in the words, 'If you won't join us, we will crack your skull.'"
You're listening to Jason Stanley on How Fascism Works. This is Independent Alternative Radio. Stay tuned at the end to learn how you can get CDs, MP3s, PDFs of this program, and Jason Stanley's book on fascism. Our website is alternativeradio.org.
Now, the relationship between fascism and work is complex. Think for a moment about the inscriptions and the gates of Auschwitz or Buchenwald. Arbeit macht frei. Work makes you free. The fascist sees in the manual laborer an image of the nation, especially in domains such as mining and manufacturing. The hardy, masculine domain of work is crucial for fascist symbology and mythology, as it were. In the miner, in the manufacturer, in the physical manual laborer, the fascist finds a powerful symbol of masculinity. So if you look at Leni Riefenstahl's Triumph des Willens, it's the masculine figure of Aryan power that you see. The worker represents that, the German. Whereas for communism, the worker is an international thing. There's no, like, the worker is a woman. It's not, the worker's not masculinized. You have men and women workers doing the same jobs because it's an international movement for equality. For National Socialism, you have women doing one thing, men doing another. You have them taking their natural orders. Women were, of course, driven out of the workplace. 1935, all women doctors were fired. The male worker is a worker who sort of plays a certain role. Fascism, as we'll see, involves this hierarchy and sort of slots for everybody in the natural order. And so the worker represents those different slots. In communist iconography, you find different people of different colors and genders all doing the same job. And that's not something you necessarily find in, you would find in fascist configurations. When Hitler denounces the German trade union movement as a tool used for socialist takeover, he is correctly identifying a powerful source of resistance to fascism. Fascism thrives when it's contrasted with a version of capitalist liberal democracy, now often called neoliberalism. Fascism thrives when, as Hannah Arendt says, individuals are atomized, and they don't have groups in which they can belong and identify. If capitalist liberal democracy is just individual agents, each seeking their way in the global economy, then how is that any vision of value? If what the alternative to a fascist movement is each of us just sinking or swimming, well, that's not a very attractive vision of life. That vision of life is invariably going to lose against a movement that promises value and meaning in the form of collective identity. Labor unions, however flawed, have always been sources where people can get together in a community. They can form a community around joint goals of lobbying against their boss. But that creates community, it creates value, it creates a joint sense of purpose. My 6-year-old son tried to organize a labor union in his class. His teacher was like, oh, great, we can put them to work now. And why not? It's like, it's a movement, it's exciting. You get together, you join together with your friends, you have meetings at night where you can organize. It gives you a sense of purpose. For fascism to succeed, it needs to destroy all competing senses of purpose. So all that's left is your ethnic identity, your national identity, your religious identity, whatever principle the fascist movement is going to take as the unifying force to give you value. And then you can reshape and refigure labor unions as movements meant for the glory of the nation. But labor unions in and of themselves, as anyone who's been involved in organizing knows, are enormous sources of resistance. They're enormous sources of community. They're enormous sources of value and purpose. Value and purpose in the service of material goals, making your life better. The weekend. Who doesn't like the weekend? At its healthiest, liberal democratic politics are people meeting at night, gathering and fomenting plans to get more time off. Trade unions, labor unions at their best protect us from insecurity. And insecurity breeds fear. And fear is the best friend of the fascist. Isolation and fear are the fascist's closest allies. So this is why the trade unions are on Pastor Niemöller's list. When you smash labor unions, when you set people into the global market, where there's no one to protect them and there's no rules to protect them, then the immigrant laborer becomes a threat, right? Because, oh no, there are no restrictions, we're just, it's sink or swim, anyone coming into the country is competing for my job. I have no protections. So fascist politics works by smashing labor unions and then leaving the people atomized and then unifying them under the nation, be it a religious nation, be it an ethnic nation, be it a cultural nation. Now, if you look at the United States today, where I come from, a harsh anti-union ideology has dominated U.S. politics for quite some time. Scott Walker came to power in the U.S. state of Wisconsin by promising to smash the power of labor unions in that state. And that traditionally Democratic state that always voted for Democratic presidential candidates for decades, went for Donald Trump in 2016. Michigan, another labor state, also went for Trump. The sources of value have been broken down in the United States. The alternative ways to get value other than ethnic, cultural, or religious identity. And that feeds into the fascist notion of a nation. In the United States today, only a small percentage of workers belong to labor unions. I believe it's only 11%. Without labor unions, we are, as problematic as they can be, in practice, each of us is an isolated, insecure,